This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon. I'm Virginia Trioli from ABC TV, from Sunday Arts and also, most recently, Late Line. And I'm delighted that you've all come this afternoon to our discussion. The very challenging title, and a title that's actually been kicked around both casually and also very seriously for the last few months that this exhibition has been on tour in Japan, Emily, the Impossible Modernist. And if you don't already know, I'll explain to you in a moment where that title comes from. The director of the National Museum of Art in Osaka, Japan, Professor Akira Tatahata, who has been the inspiration for this amazing exhibition that's now here, back here in Australia in Canberra, but first toured to Osaka and then Tokyo, described Emily Ingwari, after first being moved to tears upon seeing her work, as the impossible modernist. To him, she is, if not the greatest, then one of the greatest exponents of the modernist approach to painting. In his view, superior to some of the great American abstract expressionists. And no doubt we'll get to that. But what this topic of conversation points us towards is a discussion of what that means and why it should matter when you're talking about an Australian Indigenous painter. And to kick that around this afternoon, you're very fortunate to have two wonderful guests who know the work of Emily Kameingwari incredibly well, who know this exhibition inside out, and who know the field extraordinarily well too. So can I introduce to you, please, first Margot Neal. She's the Principal Advisor on Indigenous Matters to the Director of the National Museum of Australia and is the Principal Curator of the exhibition that I hope you've already seen, Utopia, the Genius of Emily Kameingwari. From 2000 to 2005, she was a Senior Curator and Director of the Museum's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Program and the First Australians Gallery, and she's also worked, of course, at the National Gallery of Australia, the Queensland Art Gallery, and the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Margot sits at the end here.
That's not Margot.
John MacDonald is here with us as well. He's the art critic for the Sydney Morning Herald, a role that he's held on and off for the last 20 years. He's the former head of Australian art at the National Gallery of Australia here in Canberra, and the author of a most beautiful book called Studio, which was done with the photographer Ian Lloyd, and a show of those photographs, portraits of Australian artists inside their studios, is currently on exhibition at the State Library of New South Wales, and it's shortly to travel to Victoria. In early December, the first volume of A New History of Australian Art, written by John MacDonald, is going to be published, and this first volume is called From Exploration to Federation, and that'll be a landmark publishing moment to look forward to. Would you please welcome our two guests today? I think we should go straight to the hard bit first. John, why consider Emily a modernist at all?
Well, I think to consider Emily a modernist is really to be devil's advocate. Because when you think of Australian art in general, nothing quite fits. If you think about the Heidelberg School, we called them the Heidelberg School for a long time because we didn't really feel comfortable calling them Impressionists. Now we've decided to take them at their own estimate and call them Australian Impressionists. So you've got to ask yourself whether titles like modernism are equally subject to more subjective interpretations. We think of modernism as something which is, well, to use Bernard Smith's idea, a period style now. Although modernism is in fact many different styles. Modernism is almost hard to define the boundaries thereof. But we have a sense that modernism sort of began somewhere around the turn of the 20th century, and it fizzled out somewhere in about the 1970s with all sorts of diffuse movements like earth art and conceptual art and minimalism. And then came this thing called postmodernism, which was like the hangover after the party. Now, when we think of modernism and think about it in those terms, we think of it as a whole series of ideas and styles, but as a kind of a heroic thing, pushing the boundaries as far as you could until you'd reach the end. I think when you look at Emily's work, you could say there is a case for saying she's somebody who pushed the boundaries as far as she could. She's not somebody who came in late in the piece you know, in the actual period in which she was working, which is a more of a postmodern era, and did things which were full of ironic references. She wasn't concerned with what had come before. She's somebody who is, you know, a pure painter. She's an intuitive painter. She's somebody who gets it from the heart. And I think we've got to say, modernism is also the era of, well, late colonialism, the era of rampant cultural imperialism. There was all these reasons why we might go back and venture, say, a heresy, venture a revisionist approach, venture a speculative idea that perhaps, you know, we might be able to incorporate an elderly Aboriginal lady who began painting, you know, quite late in the piece, and put her into the end of the story and say, hang on, modernism wasn't quite as dead as you thought, something else happened. So it may be a slightly tricky thing to do, but on the other hand, I think it's a lively thing to do, and it's always good with art history and with received wisdoms and orthodoxies to throw a few bombs.
We're going to I'll conduct a bit of a discussion on stage here this afternoon with our two guests, and hopefully I'll take some questions from the audience as well. But just sort of to get the ball rolling, we'll just hear some opening statements, if I can put it that way, or some thoughts from both John and from Margot. Margot, can I ask you to go first then?
Well, Ian McLean, I think, sums up probably the impression. He was one of the writers in the new National Museum of Australia catalogue, and he says, and I'm sure a sentiment everyone else feels in some degree or other, that like a siren, Emily's art seduced boatloads of modernist connoisseurs only to leave them wrecked on the rocks. Now, I don't think anyone of any connoisseurs or not can go and see Emily without this sort of interesting, you can call it, sensation of an irony or the contradictions. There's a whole range of words of how this elderly woman can paint such extraordinary works that look modernist. You know, they're modernist pictorial spaces or they're modernist in character, but the word modernist always pops up. Now, that's not unusual. You know, most of the audience who sees them comes from a Euro-American, you know, have been fed on a Euro-American diet of modernism and so on. So that's not unusual. And but the other people who don't know anything about modernism will still go in and say, how can this elderly woman from the centre of the desert start painting at 80, produce 3,000 plus works when she's so elderly? So others will comment on her output if they're not into modernism. And there's a whole range of, well, we can go on about the enigma, so-called, of Emily. I think Tadahada, we gave him a nickname, it's called Tatsy, and I've got permission to use it like that without being disrespectful. So otherwise it's Professor Akira Tadahara-san. We don't want to hear that all the time. So I think he sums it up, and Virginia actually told the story in brief, but he stands in front of Emily's, and even though I had only a photocopy of hers in the boardroom here after he'd done his tearful job at the NGV standing in front of the real one, and even then, I didn't know about that experience in the NGV, but I had it standing in front of the big yam, which is the picture you see, the first one when you enter, standing in front of that photocopy, and he started, you know, snuffling and stuff, and I thought he, you know, had sinus or, you know, Canberra sort of situation. But and he wasn't. He was actually, you know, we're running, getting him tissues, and this is a photocopy, for God's sake. And all of a sudden this almost inarticulate man in English becomes very articulate, and he's saying, you know, I can formally and technically analyse her work, I can talk about the striation of the brushwork and the variation of density and the layering and the depth, I can, you know, relate it to Bryce Marden, I can, and he's going on like this. He said, but I know where they came from. I can't explain where she's come from. It's impossible. It's impossible. And this is the impossible modernist thing. Then he goes on to say, you know, I don't know why. And then this is when he gets a little overwhelmed. And he truly is totally, you know, totally overwhelmed. And he's just revisiting what he'd seen earlier. But he also goes on to say, look, I don't mean to be sound racist or anything, he said, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really matter where or when she was born. She's whatever culture. She's a genius. She's just a genius. She's inexplicable, totally inexplicable. And then you find later that in his essay, when he's trying to write and think this through, he's saying, what I'm talking about here is how do you approach her work with the baggage of who you are and where you've come from. So he looks at her work and he says, you know, I'm a Japanese man. I'm steeped in my own cultural traditions. I'm a curator of international contemporary art. He said, I can only approach her work that way. I can't approach it any other way. And then he says, however, it's not right to approach the work of any artist without having some understanding and knowledge of the origins of their work, where they've come from, how they've been created, or you know what it is that influences their work. He said, but if I then want to take on an Aboriginal kind of perspective, which is the only way I could really understand her work, then I could be guilty of cultural colonialism. He says, so really, perhaps I should stay silent. But I can't stay silent. I'm so impassioned by this woman's work. Can't stay silent. So I'll have to find a way. So he goes through this whole kind of angst, and eventually he says, well, all I can do is, look for connections. And consider an idea of multiple modernities. There's modernities in Tokyo, there's modernities in Utopia, there's modernities in India. So I have to broaden the concept of modernity. And as John said, it's not about period style, it's about contemporary, now, the idea of the modernity of now. So he basically then, and it'll come out later, but I won't go into the way he does it, but he goes in then looking at these connections with the works of others. And he clearly defines the difference between the technical similarities on the surface, as with Jackson Pollock, or he introduces a whole new fleet of names, which is why it's good to take Australian work overseas. He talks about Kusama, Yayoi Kusama, he talks about Bryce Marden, he talks about a whole lot of... and I talk about Lee Yu-Fun, South Korean artist. So we talk about a whole range of things, but he's still... Then, and I won't sort of tell the whole story now because I'm taking too long.
That's right.
so then he, but I will just finish with just saying that, so he's being an outsider who acknowledges his position and then looks inside, but there is another person I just want to mention, and that's Ian McLean that I mentioned earlier. He said, well, I don't have any trouble. I don't know what all this enigma stuff's about, reconcilable, irreconcilables. He said, it's very clear, it's a parallel movement, you know. She doesn't have to fit into that or out of that. It's a parallel movement with intersecting points, and it's called Indigenous Modernism. And Emily actually isn't the first. She's probably well along the track. Indigenous Modernism has been occurring in Australia for 30, 40 or 50 years. And he defines it simply as having the knowledge, so a person who has the knowledge of the Aboriginal cosmology and the aesthetics to practice it, combined with the opportunity to intersect and interact with modernity. When you've got those two things in place, plus he adds a forceful personality and energy and the other things we know she has, then you've got an Indigenous modern. Now, someone might sit up and say, what about all these silly labels that really doesn't matter? Well, that's also another story. So he's got this Indigenous modernity, and it is a parallel movement. It went back to Hermannsburg, Albert Namatjira. You can even, with those criteria, you can go back even further. And that Papunya came, 10, 20 years before Emily. So she's not the beginning, but she's rather towards the end at the moment, if we're talking about now. This sort of long term consummation of a contact post-colonial period. And I think, actually she actually says, and we'll tease this out later, she explains, she says, I do a whole lot everything.
Yes. That's the key quote, and really the only quote,
yes,
that you can ever recall. Whole lot, that's what I paint, whole lot. Mm-hmm. Is what Emily Ngwari always said. We're inevitably, we keep moving back, of course, and I guess by necessity we will today move back to this word of modernity and modernism. And the idea of multiple modernities but an indigenous modernity is an interesting one that we'll move to. But before we do that, John, would you like to say a few words?
Well, indigenous modern sounds like quite an interesting sort of style of interior design, doesn't it?
It's modernity.
Okay. I thought Pat Harder was actually a Kylie Minogue fan and he got that impossible modernism thing. Yeah. Didn't she have an album called Impossible Princess?
She did.
So,
well, that's a tight, but that's a long story.
Well, what do you think? I don't know. He's very into all things Australian. So. But it is quite an extraordinary thing. I mean, one of the things which is about this show, which is, I think, unique, is that if we had gone to Japan and we had knocked on the door over there and we said, dear director of Tokyo National Museum, dear director of this museum, would you like to put on an Emily Kungwari show? They wouldn't have touched us. They would have said, thank you very much, you know, we'll call you. Whereas it all came about because Tatahata-san had a particular passion for Emily Kungwari that he had cultivated encountering her work at the Queensland Art Gallery many years ago. And he had the conjunction of this other fellow, Sakura-san, who was a former Australian correspondent for the Yomiuri Shimbun, who then became head of cultural development at the paper. And so suddenly, Sakura was in the position where he could provide the funds to make Tatahata's idea a reality. So they could be the driving force for this show. And that's a really remarkable thing, and that's how we end up having a first ever retrospective of any Australian artist, indigenous or non-indigenous, in Japan. But having said that, the great thing of this show is to take Emily out of context, to remove Emily from that Australian context, because so much Indigenous art, we've had this debate ever since the 70s onwards, if not earlier, that Indigenous art, is it a particular kind of thing that has to be dealt with in particular special ways? And to a certain extent, we can't avoid that. But on the other hand, there always reaches a point where perhaps the discussion of Indigenous art is actually limiting our appreciation of the art as art, that we're looking at it in terms of anthropological ideas, or we're relating it to a social context in a way which is unavoidable, but which in some ways also sets a kind of a threshold and the way it's seen. So, for instance, when Aboriginal art is seen overseas, you often find people dismiss it in all sorts of rather narrow ways because they don't really believe it's real art. They believe it's artefact, or they believe it's white man's art. They think it's art that's done to specifications that dealers and advisors are saying, do another one of those. And these things are, you know, they're rather patronising problems that you've got to get beyond. I remember when Arat Jara was in London, I was living there, I was talking to people who were art writers and artists, and they expressed no interest in seeing the show. And I said, why don't you want to see the show? They said, I don't want to see it. It's all just white man's art. It's just tourist art. I said, what do you want to see? And they said, I'd like to see the ancient bark paintings. Well, what ancient bark paintings? I mean the oldest bark paintings we have are these tattered little things from the 1890s. We have a few from the 1930s. But the golden age of bark painting, we're in it now. The bark paintings have never been bigger, better, more imaginative, have never been a flourishing and a magnificent art form in their own right like they are at the moment. And so if we consider all of these problems of the indigenous art in Australia versus the non-Indigenous art, presenting these things overseas, and of the extraordinary response of somebody like Tatahata to come to this, it really helps us to look again at the work ourselves. I think it's too easy for us to get caught into little boxes, caught into the politics of it, and to think about Emily perhaps as a modernist is a way of exploding those categories. I think it may not be true, but on the other hand, art history and art appreciation is not a science. You can't say if I put chemical A with chemical B, I get compound X. You cannot do that with these things. If we're discussing humanities subject, there's always going to be a very large element of opinion. There's going to be a large element of speculation. There's going to be a point we have to put combustible, incompatible things together and maybe something will come out of it. So I think this is one of those combustible ideas, and I think it could be quite a productive idea in terms of broadening our ideas of what Indigenous art is and where it fits in the great story of world art.
You've written, John, that at the National Museum of Art at Osaka, where this exhibition first went to, that Margot, if I understood correctly, hung the show in reverse, so that you actually, as a spectator, you arrived looking at the later works first. And you wrote that was terribly clever because it forced the viewer to focus on the art itself rather than what you called the anthropology of Aboriginal life, which is exactly the point that you're getting to there. Describe that experience of seeing this astonishing, what you might call, and again, I'm grasping here at Euro-American descriptors, but colour field painting when you arrive at the exhibition.
Well, Margot can describe the nitty-gritty of it, but I'll give you my first impressions. When you come through, the first thing the museum... I saw the show in Osaka. To my regret, I didn't see it in Tokyo, but it was pretty spectacular in Osaka too. The Osaka Museum is like some science fiction bunker. It's got a great big tower on top designed by Cesapelli, who's an Argentinian artist, architect. You go down the first and into the lower levels. You've got to go to the lower depths to actually see the art. So it's all enclosed. The first level down is, you know, the gift shop and the orientation. On that level, what you could see was that enormous painting called Earth's Creation, which is a spectacular introduction to Emily Kinwari because it looks superficially like it could be a work of abstract expressionism or a Monet. There's all sorts of things going on in that that people would recognise as potentially, you know, little bits of the story of Western art. Then you have the orientation room, which has the photographs and the information about the community. So you actually see where she came from. But then to go downstairs to the show proper, where it begins, what you've got is this competing message. You've got this one spectacular work of art. You've got this whole, you know, room full of artefacts and material about the community. Then suddenly you're in this show and you think, my God, what is this? Because it doesn't really look like anything that you would expect to be seeing coming from, you know, a small indigenous community in the middle of the desert. Yeah, they look like massive modern paintings. They look like the kind of things that if you change the names, you said they were all by Bill Smith, you recently discovered abstract expressionist from, you know, the East Village. Everyone would say, oh yes, yes, and they'd nod and that. You've got to, and then as you walk backwards through the career, you go through all the changes and the turns and the twists of Emily's stylistic moves. And the way Margot hung that show was a very surprising hang. It's the sort of show you ask yourself, if I was going to hang this show, would I do this? And you think, no. And you think, does it work? And you have to say, yes, it does work. And I think a lot of people had exactly that experience, that it showed that there is a way of coming at this which is unconventional, to we're walking back in time, which is totally the opposite of the absolutely fixed chronological sequence where we begin with the artist's juvenilia and we work them up to their late great period. We had the late great period at the very beginning of the show, and then we plunge back. And of course, once you'd gone to the end of the show, you felt like you wanted to walk back around again and see it in the correct chronological order. But it gave you so it was a kind of a boomerang show. Once you'd got there, you boomerang back around. And to me, that was, you know, taking full advantage of the fact that we're seeing Emily under what we must call new laboratory conditions.
And I can say from experience, because I did see the exhibition in Tokyo, it was a different sort of hang there, but again, a completely overwhelming experience there. As the curator, Margot, as someone who you want to tell the Indigenous story and the personal story of Emily with this work, how could you not? Because her life is her land, her images, it's all one, whole lot. But as the designer of the show, as the curator, and mindful that you've got this really intellectually very challenging discussion going on about the nature of where this art fits in, is that a tightrope to walk when you sort of have the, if I can say, ethnographic as well as the aesthetic that you've got to meld in some way?
Yes, I have to take on board all of those things, but one of the things that made it easier, as we've already suggested, is doing it offshore, because we could leave a lot of the baggage behind. And then some. So there's two issues. We've got Japan with a mob of people who've never heard of Emily, hardly ever heard of Australia, and certainly don't think of this as the home of any master artist. And then when they find out she's black, ancient, hasn't been to school and lives in the desert, that'd be just too much, right? So we had to kind of keep that secret for a bit. And we had lots of marketing discussions whether you should put Aboriginal in the title or not. So that, you've got that front. But the advantage of that, of course, is you've also got a clean slate, an audience who knows nothing, who knows nothing about Emily or Australia. So you can use that as a plus as well. So what is it we're trying to do here? What we're trying to do by taking this into an Australian art of a high international calibre to an international audience. What is it that struck Tatahata? What is it that will strike the people there who've just seen a Monet and it's co-built with Modigliani and followed by Cezanne, and the only blockbusters they ever have in Japan are from Europe, not America. This is the kind of audience I'm dealing with. So clearly the answer is quite simple. It's about art. So it's no good starting with her earlier decorative smaller pieces. It's no good to start with maybe batik, because there'll be the first impressions mean heaps, you know. If there's just a lot of batiks with little goannas and things running over, it'll set a frame of mind that is not the one I want. So, well, what not the one that we should be doing. So I intentionally started off with the biggest, loudest, most modernist, last works, as John said. And I was very conscious of, but I didn't want to denude it of Aboriginality either, right? Clearly it's a source. But that first you must walk through and experience it on an aesthetic level. And then you go back, as John said, through time. And when you get to in Tokyo, at least slightly different, but the idea was you go through the exhibition, and I wanted to have that circularity too, you know, the indigenous concept of the worldview as being circular, not linear. I wanted to get away from... So these are sort of hidden curriculums, if you like, but I'm very into the experience of the viewer. So I had them trailing around in this sort of way, little intimate spaces, blasts of huge vistas, and then they'd come back another way. Well, my intention was to come back in some ways like this, but it didn't happen that way. So they would actually do a circular journey through time, up and then back to the beginning. And many would, you know, do it again. So you get this circularity, which is very much whole lot, everything, Aboriginal way of seeing and being. So that was in. But then you had the idea was, you would go to the Utopia room next, which is the education room, the one I have here at the back. It's important that that wasn't up front, because when you go there, you will then get the whole, because the main thing is you'll experience it as Western, modernist, abstract art, or whatever contemporary art you know, but then it was important for you to know that it has a different source, an entirely different source. It has a source that goes beyond New York, back to 50, 60,000 years. Its root system, its lineage is ancient. So the stripes are not, you know, the stripes of Klein or somewhere. They're the stripes of body painting. Mm. So by then you get in there, and I can see people in this one. They get into the Utopia room, they look at the video, and you can hear the pennies drop. They go, whoa, I get it now. And then they hear, more than Tokyo, they then go back through the exhibition with a head full of a whole lot of other information, which didn't destroy the beginning experience, and then they can see advance, the paintings were on the backs of walls are now on the fronts of walls. And so they can go back with a whole additional dimension to their work. But one thing I'll say before I stop, in the Osaka, and then I got the confidence then to think, well, okay, we'll still slap a huge picture up, a picture of this ancient black woman with a pierced nose on that Osaka on the first floor. You'll actually see that. So you'll see this picture of this ancient woman, then the next thing you see is this amazingly modernist work, and you'll have this extraordinary kind of disconnect. And it'll build up that kind of, I've just got to find out about this. This is weird. And in fact, I used to think people would go there, they'd see this ancient black woman there, then they'd see this really modern work, and then they'd say, oh, shit, they got the signage wrong. This is the wrong exhibition, you know. And then they'd sort of get confused. So I'd rather like that unsettling, you know, thing, because it's only five more steps and then you're kind of absorbed into these huge pictures. Oh, it took a long time to say that, didn't it?
Margot, there's sometimes just no point stopping you. But I'll try.
Yeah.
That's what the Japanese found.
But the Japanese, of course, as you will probably know, are enormously polite, and you would see them there sort of kind of bending under the weight of Margot sometimes in Tokyo. She would just keep going.
Moral weight.
Terrible.
The moral weight.
The great way to Margot. Now, I think it's important that we just spend a little bit of time, as we have, talking about this exhibition in Japan, even though, of course, you know, it's next door and you've seen it, because more to give you that sense of separation that was the ambition in Japan, to speak about this painter freed up from those shackles of the context that I know a lot of indigenous artists sometimes find quite overbearing as well, that they're locked into a certain box in a certain context. So I hope the discussion of you imagining what it might be like as someone from that country going to see these works, which are, you know, astonishingly still, you know, shocking and vibrant when you think of them, you know, coming from the desert, how that must have been redoubled for those people, I think will give you that sense of distance then in wanting to discuss the concept of Emily and modernity. John, you've said that if modernism is more a case of style and technique rather than tradition, that Emily may be considered the last great modernist of the 20th century. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was thinking particularly of paintings like that Big Yam Dreaming,
which is the big black one
with meandering white lines. Now, that is a painting that I'm sure that when a lot of people, you know, who have cut their teeth on art in America or Europe see it, they would think of people like Bryce Marden, who also is known for his meandering lines. And shortly after I'd seen the Emily show, I actually saw a big Bryce Marden show. And it was really quite an interesting experience because the Bryce Marden show felt incredibly flat.
That's how I find it.
It felt to me like a very lifeless show. It was like a kind of a precious show that he'd spent a lot of time thinking about painting grey stripes, and then he'd spent a bit of time thinking about painting a kind of meandering grey line. But even the meandering grey line had a sense of, now I'm going to do another really sensitive line. Whereas when you look at Emily's work, you don't feel like there's a moment's self-consciousness.
Well, tell us about how Emily works with a painting like that in particular. You know the story of how she made it.
Well, of course, how she works is quite extraordinary. You can't imagine anybody working like the way she worked.
Paint a picture for us.
She would basically have this canvas of whatever size stretched out on the ground. She would have the paints in that arranged around her and the brushes, maybe quite a thick brush, sometimes like a shaving brush, and she would just start to work. Bang, 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 bang. And gradually, I think Margot has filmed and stop motion photography, she would gradually work her way across the canvas, cross-legged, painting, 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 until she had covered the entire canvas from one end to the other, and then get up and walk away without even looking at it. Now, it's almost unheard of because we all think of the artist as somebody who makes a mark and then stands back and considers that mark, then goes back and makes another one. But this is not the case at all. This is painting which is done almost by, you know, remote control.
Margot, she started, we've just missed it, it was just the work
you
back, I'm sure
it,
you
yeah,
saw
no,
it.
No.
But she started at the sort of bottom left or went up to the
middle.
Top right, middle and top
huge,
right.
Big canvases, when even in the book you'll see her working on Earth's creation and her sitting on it, but she starts in various places. But if it's a huge canvas like the one we saw in Earth's creation, she'll sit in the middle. She may start on the outer edge and move to the middle, but mostly in the middle if it's big. And the thing about Earth's creation is she actually, it's like knitting. She does, it's quite measured and almost automatism. Mm. You know, it's sort of quite measured and she'll go left hand, right hand, sometimes both hands, as people who don't read and write often will be ambidextrous. So she really just, and you'll see in that video there, she simply knits one bit into another, into another, into another, and then she'll fall off the edge of the canvas, so to speak. Mm. And in the video I have there, you'll see it, but those ones on the end are quite, you know, parallel lines, dense. So there's wide open netting, and then there's very dense netting and wide open netting. And for the very observant, you see lots and lots of dog prints, because there were lots, she had lots of helpers.
Dogs everywhere.
Dog hairs.
Dog hill and doggy prints all over it. And then she gets up, and as John said, it is quite true. She gets up, finishes, and she's off. And look, you can drive a bulldozer over it after. She doesn't care. right? As long as you're paid first, perhaps. But she really doesn't care. And why doesn't she care? Because doing a canvas for an Aboriginal woman like her and many others is performing a ceremony. So when the ceremony's finished, the ceremony's finished. The performance ground is then erased, either with the feet, the dancing of the feet, or otherwise, and in fact no vestiges should remain. The power is you know, derived from the earth. So the idea of sitting on the earth, in fact, also has a very symbolic thing. Sitting on the earth, deriving the power from the earth, but in this case it's also the physical way of being, and then the power is then reinvested into the work. And in fact, when she paints, many paintings, she will be chanting and singing as she goes. So sort of in her mind's eye, she's actually going over country and revisiting parts and sites. And in some other paintings, she will actually, part of the way through, she'll sort of touch each part and then she'll go into sort of a chanting, and if someone's with her, they'll join in, and then there'll be this thin kind of intonement, and then she'll move to another part and another part. So it is, in fact, ceremony, and so the idea of it being significant, how you hang it, where you hang it, what you do with it, she doesn't care. It's your
okay, well, with that then, I mean, that always provokes in me the same question, really, which is, then why are you or Professor Tarahata, why does anyone try and want to make me think of this work in terms of modernism? Modernism seems irrelevant to that. Why can I not see her in terms of, and I'll use the word, a primitivist impulse? There seems absolutely nothing wrong with that. She comes from this performing tradition that's integral to the work, and it frankly seems a lot more rich and interesting than the modernist tradition of say, Pollock and others.
Except she's painting it for an outside audience.
I think what's interesting is it opens up our concept of modernism, because if you look at a lot of modernist art, and we've seen bits and pieces flashing on the screen, modernism draws on so many different sources. Modernism is monstrously eclectic. It draws on primitivism. It draws on the naive art of people like the Douanier Rousseau.
Yep.
It draws on African tribal carving. It draws on Eastern Russian ink painting. There was a lot of artists in the 60s who, you know, felt from Hans Hartung to Franz Klein that it was to do with this gestural mark. Now, if I think to actually have that show initiated by the Japanese and shown in Japan is a really fascinating new context in which to see somebody like Emily Kung-Worry. Because if you read about Chinese and Japanese ancient brush and ink painters, the first thing they always say is, first sit cross-legged on your mat. Now, first, so they're all sitting cross-legged, as indeed Emily used to sit cross-legged, and you get your chi up. And so when you finally get to make those marks, they talk about, well, in Zen Buddhism, they talk about muga, which is a union where mind and body act together and you don't even think about it, but it's done perfectly. It's a philosophy of action. So whether you're painting a picture or you're firing an arrow, it's done without self-consciousness, but it's done with such training and with such preparation that it's done correctly. When you think of, and then it takes you into other concepts which are very important for brush and ink painting in the Orient. The Chinese, the Chan people called it Wu. The Zen people called it, and a lot of other Buddhism called it Satori, which is that moment of revelation, that moment of awareness where the painting just works and the thing is there, but it happens without knowledge, it happens without calculation, without self-consciousness. You could not find a less self-conscious painter in the history of world painting than Emily Kung-Worry. They talk about it as the opening of the mind flower or the removal of the bar. Well, all of these things, which are concepts that meant a hell of a lot to all the people who were being beat in San Francisco in the 50s and 60s, they were all spouting this stuff. They were all talking about it. They were all trying to do things that were spontaneous and freeing their mind flowers and opening and removing the bar. Well, they're sometimes hanging around the bar for a long time. But these are concepts which actually fed the great polyglot, multicultural, image thing that we consider modernism to be. And so by taking in elements of that and applying them back to Emily, I think we're kind of unravelling the crazy quilt of modernism, and we're seeing where all the threads actually go back to.
Well, we're seeing something completely different altogether, just because she does modernism better than perhaps they did modernism, or she does it less self-consciously. Does that make it modernism? Doesn't it make it something else altogether?
It doesn't make it not.
But the thing is, what is, well, modernism in many ways, we have to say, is a spent force. It is a period style. It sort of existed until about the 70s, or so they say. If Emily's a modernist, she's a late-blooming modernist. She's a kind of a modernist avant la lettre. After the lettre, actually, après la lettre.
She's a modernist redux.
Yes. We think that with art now, it was very easy for a long time to divide paintings and painters, sculptors, schools, into a series of discrete movements that all fit neatly within the history books. Then we had, you know, Fauvism, Expressionism, Suprematism, Constructivism. We're now in a position where there really are no isms. We're beyond isms. Postmodernism was the last great ism, and that was a complete mess. That was really an ism which was there to leech onto all the other previous isms and to more or less make them look silly. And to make itself look silliest of all.
It's a particular soapbox of Johnson.
but what we have now is an era of individuals. And also we have an era which has gone beyond a lot of the national ideas of art. We don't so much have shows of Australian art. We have shows in which artists participate who happen to be born in Australia or live in Australia. And it's the same all over the world. You may be born in Albania, you may be born in Pago, but you end up in these shows.
I want to try and get to some questions from the floor in just a moment. But, Margot, can I get you to speak to a really interesting observation that you quote, I think, in your essay in the catalogue, made by Professor Anne McGrath. She said, whether intended or not, the ubiquitous description of Emily and her work as miraculous and enigmatic carries a subtext that says it's not possible for Australian Aboriginals to reach such heights and to produce such sophisticated work, which is the flip side of what we're talking about when, if you want to talk about being Indigenous or being primitive. Why did that observation mean so much to you?
Well, that was stimulated by being the year of the apology, because when we opened the SARC, it was only 3 weeks later, and we were thinking about, and Andrew Pike over here from Roman Films and I, we had a few discussions, thinking about what effect does this whole apology idea of acknowledging and recognising Indigenous people in the way it has been and bringing us into the fore. What effect will it have on the way we see Emily or the way we see Indigenous art in Australia in any event? And I was trying to think about the idea that Aboriginal people have always been seen historically as a problem to be solved, or dysfunctional or needing more resources than anyone else. And it's rarely been acknowledged, the contribution has rarely been acknowledged, the Cathy Freemans and the, you know, and the Emilys and a whole lot of other things. And if it is, it's because, well, not in Emily's case, but, you know, because of the white in them or because of, you know, they're exceptional or they can't. So basically the whole idea of you can't any longer, after the apology and Emily and a few other things, you can't see Aboriginal people as not capable it's impossible to see Aboriginal art in a primitivist paradigm. And I know it's, you know, we haven't kind of got to the end of how all this works, but we were actually thinking about it. Why should it be miraculous, really, that Emily can do fantastic work like that? Why should it be any more miraculous than Fred Williams or Jackson Pollock? Or why should it be miraculous? Because she's black?
It's interesting. When I read that, and you know, we know that she had no formal training. She came to painting extremely late in life. She was unaware of these artistic movements. And to me, in a sense, I mean, the cultural parallel is not exact, but a reasonably untutored and uneducated Jane Austen at a very young age picked up her pen and wrote six of the best novels ever written in the English language, and that's considered sheer talent.
Yeah, well, there's a whole... I mean, George O'Keefe and people like that painting. There's a whole history of people who come to things early or late, untutored. In fact, you know, I dare say you're more chance of being somebody if you're untutored. Well, you don't go to art school.
says someone who works in, you know, the institution, but anyway.
But I am not the only one.
In one of the reviews, when I tried to deal with this idea of genius, because, you know, the genius of Emily Pengwarrior, which is being flourished around like a great banner. But
good word, that.
And well, yeah, you can call somebody a genius and half your audience go gasp and the other half go, ugh, because there's a tremendous scepticism about, you know, what a genius is or isn't. And I talked about well, Wolfgang Hildesheimer's book on Mozart, which is a fascinating book. It's a biography about biographies. And he says, why is it that we understand Mozart to be a genius? And he says, well, look, he says, Mozart would go off with his mates and be playing billiards and having a few drinks. And while he's playing billiards, waiting his turn, holding his cue, he's going on the windowsill. He goes home and writes down Piano Concerto 21, note perfect. Now that's a genius. Whereas Hildesheimer talks about all the other people who are would-be geniuses who have a very strong sense of themselves as geniuses, perhaps waiting to be discovered, or knowing they'll be discovered posthumously, which gives them some comfort. But the self-conscious genius does everything the way a genius should.
Mm.
You know, they do everything in a very genius-like way.
Part.
They make sure everybody notices that they're being geniuses. Mm. And so much art founders on the would-be genius aspect, when people sit down to make great art. Well, I'm going to make great art today. And Emily was totally unselfconscious. She's an artist who is as unselfconscious as any Zen Buddhist. She's somebody who just... She'd have to sit cross-legged on a mat for days until she could make the first mark. She just hops straight in. And it's a remarkable thing. It's something that we have to see as talent. If you can't call that talent, what can you call it? And perhaps it's talent which is nurtured and shaped by the circumstances of her life, where she's in the desert. She's in this pure kind of bare place without all the distractions and all the other things. She's in a place where she's heir to a long oral culture. She's got a strong relationship to the land that a lot of, you know, the rest of us don't have, but 99.9% of us don't have. Those things are the shaping factors, but you can't really account for the fact that Emily sits down and paints this remarkable body of work, whereas all of the other Indigenous artists out there may, you know, they do good or bad stuff, but nobody quite hits the mark to the degree she hits the mark. You've got to call that talent, and perhaps you've got to call it genius.
Well, that's exactly where the word genius came from in the title. As you can imagine, we had to come up with a title that suited me and the Japanese. And we thrashed this around for some time, and I actually, as you can imagine, was a bit averse to the genius being such a Eurocentric kind of title. But they explained to me that in Japanese that means talent. So that, you know, and they've come up with this in Japanese, a much longer kind of thing, but it basically means talent from the Australian desert, which got translated into genius in the English language for the purposes of this. So, and the other Gina, what's the Latin for Gina loci, the place?
Genius loci, yes. Means the spirit of place.
Yes, well, I also, so when I used the word genius, I thought the way I could justify its use to myself in an Australian context was this reference to place, because that was the source of all the spirituality and the power and through these ancestral connections with Alhulkara, which every single painting in there is about one subject, Alhulkara. And that's, so I found sort of comfort in using it in that context.
Anyone thought of an observation or a question that they'd like to ask while you have these two wonderful guests with you this afternoon? Yes? And you might like to bear in mind if there's something that you'd like to ask.
Yeah.
Could you tell us...
Yes, it's on.
Tell us a little bit about what brought the Emperor to see the exhibition and what effect that had.
Numbers.
If you get him, they will come.
No, what happened is... As you can imagine, for all the reasons we've explained, the Japanese didn't have any taste for this Emily, right, whoever she was. So we knew it would be a great show. How are we going to get people in? Oh, my philosophy was we've got to get in, you know, celebrities, politicians and royalty, and then we've got the Japanese, right? They're followers. And to that end, I actually put in Elton John's Emily, you know, so they could be convinced that there are other people in the whole wide world who actually buy Emily's, people that they know of celebrity status. The royalty thing, actually, we were angling all the time to get... We did actually have a princess open it. Not the princess, a princess. But we knew, I was hoping that she'd go back and tell all the other princesses how good it was.
She's rather unkindly known in Japan as Princess Envelope.
Is that, I heard you say that before. What does that mean?
She'll turn up to the opening of an envelope this
princess. Oh, I do. But anyway, she's a great vehicle for the rest of them. So she, and she's a very, you know, lady with 5 degrees, speaks Oxford type English. She was really interested in this stuff and was really enthused. The embassy continued to work on it, and they thought for promotion purposes, you know, it'd be really good to get the crown prince. Well, they did, and unbeknownst to them, of course, in the last minute, the princess, the rarely ever seen princess, his wife, also came along. Well, that got every newspaper in the country going, because this was seen as a Yomiuri Shimbun sponsored show, so the others wouldn't necessarily touch it. But when the rarely ever seen princess turned up, everybody covered it. And then Therese Raine, you may also know that Kevin Rudd and Therese Raine visited the show whilst in Japan. We sort of made sure there's some meetings scheduled that day so it didn't fall on the site so it wouldn't fall off the schedule. She tells me, Therese Raine tells me, that they were meeting the Empress that night. And this sounds a lot like name dropping, doesn't it? that night, and that she told the Empress about this great show and how it had this golden waterfall in it, which is that batik, right? And the Empress said, no, it must be a golden cascade or something. So some conversation on these terms went on, so I'm sure that played a contributing part, but the embassy did a lot as well. But I wish she'd come earlier. They came in the last, last week or 10 days before she came, you know, so by the last day or two there's 4,000 people squeezing in.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it started a few weeks early it would have been easy. Does that answer your question?
Yes. fellow in that striped T-shirt here.
I just wondered how long it might have taken for us to be having a meeting like this in the National Gallery with this type of exhibition of the art if this hadn't happened in Japan.
Can you say it again?
I wonder whether we have had a cultural cringe operating here, how long it might have taken for us to have this level of appreciation we're now getting for Emily Kingwari if this event hadn't taken place in Japan.
Well, what's that saying? A prophet's only ever, appreciated in a
foreign land.
In a foreign land. So it's an element of that.
You've got to say that we spent most of the 80s and a large part of the 90s sending shows of Australian art to various overseas venues, telling them this was Australian art. And it was basically Australian art that looked a bit like their art.
Mm.
We sent people back to Europe and America that looked like the sort of things that people in Europe and America were doing. At the same time, you have the rise of Aboriginal art, which creates a double thing. Some people only think of Australian art as Aboriginal art. A lot of artists who are not Aboriginal resent the fact that Aboriginal art gets all of this special attention. But when you look back, the first, you know, ever serious show of an Australian artist in Japan, and who'd made a Japanese museum is Emily Kingwari. Ooh. The first serious retrospective of an Australian artist in European museums has been John Mwangel, who was shown at the Tangeli Museum in Basel and then at the Springel in Hanover. So these two, you know, magnificent Aboriginal artists have basically been flagships for Australian art in general and have been signs that the rest of the world is genuinely interested in seeing something different and something that individuals have come and seen those shows, have seen that work and noticed and seen how very, very strong it is and feel as though the surprise that they have experienced in front of those works could be translated back to their audiences back home. But they take the responsibility upon themselves to show those works and to sell those works to an unfamiliar audience. Whereas it relies so much on those individuals. You've just got to have the people who are very keen to do it. Because I've begun to think that it would make more sense for Australian art institutions and funding bodies to find a few truly courageous, visionary, dynamic people in Japan and Europe and America and bring them out and give them a jolly good look at everything and let them go back and lay their plans what they might want to do rather than continually keep trying to send shows and promote lost causes and send culls to Newcastle. Like every time we do with the Venice Biennale, we always send them something that looks like the thing they were looking at about 4 years ago. and we ignore the thing that people actually come here and look at and say, that's really interesting. I mean, the classic case is Fiona Hall. When I was at the National Gallery, I had to take all these people around to look at the shows, and the one they always stopped in front of me said, oh, look at this, this is amazing. Have we ever sent her to a Venice Biennale? No. We've sent everything else that looks like the things that everyone else has sent there in previous years. We do it every time. We don't have a very smart or very adventurous or proactive policy when it comes to getting people genuinely interested in Australian art abroad. And so the Emily show and the John Mwangel show have been absolute landmarks, and we should take lessons from those things.
Yeah, the cultural cringe is well and truly alive, yeah.
But it's important to note that there has been, and you were part of it, the retrospective of Emily's work here in Australia. Was it the Queensland?
I did the first, the one that Tata Hada went to.
That's right, yeah.
It's a national touring retrospective in Australia.
So, I mean, your question was about the NGA, but there has been the national touring show of her work here in Australia, so it's not as if that's
still
been utterly overlooked and only happened in Japan.
But it's interesting that the Mwangel show, for instance, couldn't find a venue
in Australia. Mm. And that was politics, basically.
Mm. We're running short of time, and I'm a demon for time, so do we have another question? Yes, lady in a red jacket right at the front here.
Where to from here, Margot? Where's Emily going from here?
She's going home.
Oh, no.
Back to all her many generous lenders and owners.
She's going back to all her lenders, yeah.
For how long have these owners and lenders had works out of their hands?
Well, we collected their work probably... there's a lender in here. January or February, so by the time this is finished, in 2 weeks' time, tell all your friends, 2 weeks' time, they'll all be back at home by October, November. Mm. That's not to say, this particular tour is finished, but that's not to say, there can't be a request from, as we've heard mentioned many times, New York or London or so on, and there's been lots of murmurs, lots of noises, but, it's another exercise, and we know where the works are, we know where the crates are, we know where the expertise is. We just need the money. It's not that sad, really. I think everyone here should put pressure on Craddock to extend it for another week.
Before we go, if you can, briefly.
I'll try really hard.
Can you, I think it's really interesting, and it's a nice sort of punctuation point for our discussion. Can you share with us the response of so many Japanese when they went to see the show, and in particular members of the public? And I know you had some wonderful vox pops, and I was lucky enough to be over there to film a story for the Sunday Arts program on the ABC, which I do hope you saw on the Emily show. And we spoke to a number of people, and I was, as I think Margot was, just completely blown away at this instinctive and intelligent understanding by the Japanese of, if I can say, the vocabulary of Emily's mark making and what that signified. Mm. What struck you about it, Margot?
I might actually draw in on Andrew too a little bit here, because he's Andrew Pike from Ronan Films. By the way, there's a film being made, a documentary of this over the last three years. And Andrew has actually been, and we had a session here last week on looking at, in fact, some of these interviews with subtitles. And I'll start off with a few, but Andrew, you might like to come in with some that you remember.
We may or may not have time, but we'll just quickly go for it, Margaret, then we'll see how we go.
Just very quickly, I think it was quite extraordinary, as Virginia was saying, the degree to which the Japanese we spoke with anyway, doing vox pops, the degree to which, without knowing anything about the indigenous context, we're able to find points of identification within Japanese culture with these ostensibly abstract, ostensibly modernist works. And they had no trouble finding meaning within the, within the stripes, within the dots. I just wonder whether we're going to see a great school of Japanese dot painting.
Every school
coming
of Emily in Japan. Oh, sure we are. Yeah, well, that's it's exactly this. It's not as... I mean, clearly people see relationships with calligraphy and the pink dots with cherry blossom and the big vertical hangs. And I actually played on the known to the unknown with this, and hanging paintings as sort of Japanese scrolls. So clearly they're the sort of material points of entry. But the main thing was this this enormous, everyone seemed to talk, not everyone, lots of people seemed to talk about the enormous energy they got from this work. Some talked about the healing powers of the work. Some talked about this mysterious presence that gave them shivers, the spirituality, the energy, all of those, a lot of those kind of words were used a lot.
Mm. I think we'll leave you with memories of that terrific energy this afternoon. Can you please thank our guests, Margot Neal and John McDonald?
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.